You know, back in the day, for a musician, if you had an engagement, it meant you got a gig. Today, it means you got a like or a view. So many musical artists today are grappling with what it means to generate engagement on social media, to grow their audience in a meaningful way while staying on trend, feeding the algorithm, and showing up in the feed. What to share, how to share it, how often, and why, and how to manage the critics, too. You'd like to think it would be enough just to make beautiful work. But then you have to figure out how to communicate about it in a compelling way, and there's so much noise to cut through. All of which is to say, not everyone is a natural fit for a life online. But for some people, it almost feels like a calling. Dodie is one of those people. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. About 15 years ago, a teenage girl from Essex in England named Dorothy Clark started sharing videos on YouTube. She sang songs and she told stories about her life. She was a bit of a misfit. She felt slightly outside of her social scene at school. She was sensitive and sweet, earnest and innocent. But she took naturally to making videos. She developed her own visual language and she had an ease on camera that grew alongside her musical identity. She picked up a ukulele, she began writing songs, and she went by her nickname, Dodie. She was also open about her mental health, her relationships, and her sexuality, becoming a kind of artful chronicler for a chronically online generation. Within a few years, Dodie was independently putting out her own EPs and breaking into the top 40. She sold out the Roundhouse in London even before her first full-length album, Build a Problem, came out. And when it was eventually released, it landed at the top of the charts. All on the strength of her YouTube channel and her natural talent for communicating, both musically and personally, with her audience. I first discovered her through a version of the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun that she made with another London prodigy from the YouTube generation, Jacob Collier.
Little darling, the smiles returning to the faces. Little darling, it seems like years since it's been you. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun, and I say, it's alright.
Since then, she's released a small handful of EPs and singles and two full-length albums. The latest, which is called Not For Lack of Trying, came out earlier this year.
Forgive me, I wrongly assumed. Though when I found you in the back of a room, you'd want to talk about it. But no one wants to talk about it.
And she's collaborated with fellow digital natives like Corey Wong, Leve, and Pomplemousse. Through all of this, she's maintained a direct and homespun relationship with her followers, mostly on YouTube and Instagram. Today, her music has been streamed over a billion times. She's got millions of followers online. In 2023, that was recognized with a spot on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list. She would not qualify for that list anymore, by the way. She turned 30 this year. Now, with her new album, Not For Lack of Trying, she's sharing what it means to come through that journey, a little wiser, a little more grounded, and maybe even happy. We sat down in New York City to talk about growing up online, setting boundaries, learning to feel better, and writing songs that make sense of it all. Third-story.com is the place to visit the archive. Hundreds of deep dives like this one, including past conversations with some of Dodie's pals like Jacob Collier and Corey Wong, plus other creative captains who've spent their fair share of time paddling in the content stream. The guys in Wolfpack, Ryan Lerman of Scary Pocket, Stella Cole, and Aaron, who just happens to be on tour opening for Dodie right now. You'll also find interviews with groundbreaking female artists who paved the way for people like Dodie. Those include Ani DeFranco, Imogen Heap, and Paula Cole. Visit my Substack for all the latest musings and milestones. That's where I publish new episodes, too. It's leosidran.substack.com. And remember, The Third Story is made in partnership with WBGO Studios. You can find more about all of their award-winning content at wbgo.org/studios. Speaking of which, The Third Story is the proud recipient of a 2025 Signal Award. So thank you for making me look so good. Here's me and Dodie talking it down earlier this month in the New York offices of her label, Verve. Are you getting a cold?
Yes, I am. How did you know?
Because you said it yesterday on Instagram.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I am. Yeah. I had a live session this morning and I think I'm like right before it will like sound really bad. So
yeah.
I'm glad I got to do it before.
It feels worse than it sounds right now. I was thinking about that piece of your life where you share so many things that are going on in your life publicly and then you walk into a room and some stranger says, are you getting a cold? And you say, how did you know that? Yeah. Meanwhile, you shared it with like a million people
yesterday. I don't know why. I guess because like usually when I do interviews, well, they'll have like an idea of who I am, but they might not have like kept in check of like everything I'm posting. But
right.
For you to do research.
But it also made me think, when I had the opportunity to talk to you, I was thinking how you are a particularly unusual person to interview, because it never even occurred to me that you would want to do an interview or need to do an interview, because your life has been so, like, you've been in charge of your narrative, basically, from the beginning. Mm. It almost made me wonder what the experience of having somebody else talk to you about your narrative is, considering you've been so forthcoming about everything that you're going through.
Mm. Cool question. Oh. Thank you. Yeah. I love it. Well, I think with interviews specifically, firstly, I don't know who's going to read this. Sorry, what?
Oh, it's a podcast. They're going
to
hear it.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Hello. Hello. But if it were to be any of the people who follow me who have sought it out, then I feel like I trust them enough to like share a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Like back in the day, I used to make a lot of videos just about like anything I was thinking or feeling all the time. I probably should have like put a filter on it. But I was young and I wasn't feeling well, so I wanted to do that. And now I think I have a lot more of a boundary. And so I don't like necessarily blast everything I'm thinking all the time. But when I'm in an interview, it might come up.
Sure.
So I guess we'll see.
That's interesting that you have a boundary now. I mean, did you learn to put a boundary up as you realized that more people were paying attention?
Yeah, I think so. There was like a particular period of time around like 2018 mm-hmm. where like my mental health has always been something I've like talked about. But I think what's so funny is that obviously you can't like detach from your mental health. So to talk about it is to be it as well. So I was like almost like convincing myself that talking about my depression was like a useful, healthy thing for people, because a lot of people would say, oh my God, thank you so much, you're being so open, you're so authentic or whatever. And I was like, oh, this is good. And so the irony is like, I would almost feel more fulfilled the more depressed I was.
Mm. Because you'd get some sort of feedback,
yeah,
positive feedback,
yeah,
for your depression.
Yeah. So yeah, that was in like, yeah, 2018 was like the pinnacle of that. I think this is maybe like TMI, but I think I posted something on my Snapchat that was like borderline like suicidal thoughts. Mm-hmm. Like, and then a friend messaged me and was like, dude, like, this is just inappropriate. Mm. And at first I was really angry. I was like, how dare you? Like, you know, I'm allowed to post whatever I like. Like, you know, I've been told I'm helping people.
Right. And people are telling me that I'm helping them.
Yeah, yeah. But obviously I was also getting a lot of feedback from people saying I was like romanticizing depression and like celebrating it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a lot of people being like, a lot of comments who I think I like disregarded as like mean in a way, but also it like tapped into something that hurt of like, oh, you know, you're just romanticizing your mental health. Like maybe I was causing damage and like making depression look too nice or pretty or whatever.
Mm.
And so I think I fed that feedback from my friends through that lens until I just took a bit of time and I was like, yeah, actually, fair enough. So I like took a big step back and I took some time to figure out what I actually wanted to share. And it turns out it was a lot less. And now I share a lot more in my songs.
Maybe that was the sort of rite of passage, as you realized you have this other vehicle to share it in a more controlled and maybe not necessarily artful, but intentional way.
Mm.
You know, because you're certainly sharing plenty of things in this new batch of songs, and you have been sharing things in your songs. And it's funny because I have to remind myself to check people's Instagrams. You know, I like listened to music and I was on YouTube. And then finally I was like, I bet Instagram is going to give me the most up-to-date information.
Yeah.
And I saw a few things. I saw that you have a cold. And I also saw this post from earlier this summer where you're sitting on a bench and grappling with the fact that you might be feeling good.
Yeah.
And confused about whether or not this is actually happiness or contentment that you're feeling right now. And that was an example of putting it in public rather than in the music. But the name of your album is Not For Lack Of Trying. It refers to the song where you say, lend me some joy. I can't find mine, but not for lack of trying. Something like that. I don't mean to misquote you.
No,
but
lend me joy, I can't see mine. But not for lack of trying.
I suspect that you wrote that song before
you discovered pharmacological interventions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I tell people antidepressants were truly a last resort.
Yeah,
which is silly. But I am also glad it took me this long to find them, because I think I really wanted to like try everything, and yeah. I've tried so many things.
Yeah.
So many things. I've tried antidepressants before. I didn't like them. I've tried hypnotherapy. I've tried TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is where you put on a silly hat and they blast electromagnetic pulses at parts of your brain that might need more like blood flow or stimulation. Didn't work. Well, it worked a bit,
yeah.
But not that much. What else have I tried? Just loads of therapy, loads of different therapy. And my mental health has gone through like a lot of waves, but the past year, or the year that I wrote that song in, yeah. For Lack of Trying, and a lot of these songs as well, I was like cuckoo, like,
yeah,
real crazy.
So what is it like for you now to roll out this collection of cuckoo crazy songs and confront them from this vantage point?
Yeah, it's cool. Some of them are definitely like based around this time. There's a song called Now, mm-hmm. actually, which I wrote when I was feeling really, really bad, mm-hmm. in this bad year. And I was so angry at myself for writing all of these songs that are just so depressing. I was like, oh God, the only thing I want to write about, because the only thing I was thinking about was how bad I felt.
Mm.
It was like this bad cycle. So I was like, okay, I'm going to try and stretch my brain and write a song about how I want to feel, like how I might feel if I'm feeling good. So it's like, you know, sunshine, big trees, oh.
It's like, what would the words be that a person who's feeling, yeah, okay would,
yeah,
say?
Yeah, like, oh, I'm happy as a dog with, yeah, head out the window.
Rush hour, golden glow, happy as a dog with a head out the window.
And that was so sad to write, because I really, really, really wanted to be there. And now I'm feeling much better. And it's interesting how accurate my viewpoint was. I was right. I
knew that is how, what it feels like.
Yeah, I knew where I wanted to be. I just couldn't get my brain there. But
you have another song where you say, I'm fine. I'm fine. But it's, you know, maybe it's one of those things where it's like, I'm not fine.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody says to you, I'm fine, really, I'm
yes.
I'm good. Thank
yes.
you, I'm good.
Yes.
They're kind of trying to convince themselves.
Yeah.
Roll it up, smoke it up, when you live to figure it out. Big, brave girl, 29 now. I'm fine now, really I'm fine now.
I think I really like it, especially in the end. I repeat, I go into this more like rhythmic section. I'm like, wake up, a mistake, but no, really I'm, really I'm sinking, oh, really I'm. And then at the end, it like repeats, really I'm, really I'm, really I'm.
Wake up, a mistake, but no, really I'm, really I'm sinking, the feeling, oh, really I'm, really I'm. Listen from a distance, oh, really I'm.
And I was like, oh, actually, I think that's really powerful, because I'm like, it's like, it's almost like I'm out of breath, like I can't even say it, you know, anymore. Really, really, guys, like really, really. But I'm not. I'm like, I really was not at all okay.
The other thing in that song, that, and it's not the first time you've done it, is you put your age, which of course is constantly changing on you.
Yeah.
You had a song on your last record where I think originally you said I'm 24. A Special Girl, that's the one I'm talking,
yes,
about, where you are counting all the people you've kissed.
So this is it now. 24, I still count everyone I kiss.
Yes.
And then in your tiny desk you say I'm 27, because, uh-huh, you performed it 3 years later.
Yes.
So this is it now, 27, I still count everyone I kiss.
But I was just thinking, as you write this song, you're going to have to confront that you wrote it when you were 29 for the rest of your life.
Mm. I think that's really important. I think that's why I wanted to do that. Because, yeah, for me, 29... And I don't know if this is how everyone feels. I think it is quite common, but like, I just didn't realize just how much I would freak out about turning 30.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of my videos, and like whenever anyone asked me about turning older or aging, I'd be like, no, I can't wait. You know, I've often said like, there'll be a point in my life where I get bangs forever. And like, we've passed that threshold now. These are staying. Or like, my mum's eyesight went bad at like 40. So I'm like, okay, there'll be a time when I get glasses, and that'll, yeah, be glasses forever. And I can't wait to like have my kooky big glasses and big fringe, and like, it's gonna be sick. But then when it happened and I was 29, staring at this like line between what felt like youth and, mm-hmm, adulthood, in the way that is like terrifying. And a lot of my thoughts, we won't go into it, were around death. A lot of them just around death and losing people and grieving and my fear of grieving. And to step into 30 meant that I was stepping into a world now where instead of looking back at my youth all the time, I almost like changed my whole viewpoint, and suddenly I was looking at all of those terrifying things to come. I was so scared. Still am. I could cry talking about it. So I think to like capture that feeling in a song was really important to me. I wanted to make sure that I put 29 in it so I would always remember. Not that I'll ever forget, but yeah.
What you were feeling.
Yeah.
I wonder if part of it, you know, you were compelled to share on the internet. You're a digital native. You were raised with access to, you know, YouTube was just a reality for you. So you started so young, and you know, like I began by asking you about managing your public and private lives. Like, it's like, did you ever see the movie The Truman Show?
Yeah.
There's a little aspect of that where you can, I saw your video 5 years ago where you were celebrating having had your YouTube channel for 10 years, and you did this cut of all of these beautiful.
Oh, I love that video.
And it's very emotional, but it's also emotional because there you are, excited that you have 4,000 followers,
4,000 subscribers,
starting to play ukulele.
I attempted to play the ukulele, although I can't do it very well.
Inviting people to celebrate your successes, performing for the first time.
Having a gig.
And moving to London.
And I'm excited to live in London because all of my friends.
It's crazy, actually, how emotional that is.
I'm nothing special, in fact. I'm a bit of a bull.
But you're growing up, and it's all kind of tied to your growing up.
If I tell a joke, you've probably heard it before.
And then at a certain point, you sort of, it's not that you're not done changing, we're constantly changing.
But I have a talent, a wonderful thing, 'cause everyone listens when I start to sing. I'm so grateful and proud.
But you're not kind of growing into an adult anymore, you've become an adult.
All I want is to sing it out loud.
So I can see like 30 was hard for me, 30's hard for everybody. But for you in particular, because it's just been so public and kind of performative in a way, I can see how that would be really a lot.
Yeah, I think growing and changing and like imagining that with the public thing, it has definitely been really confusing. Just so many things that happen in life that I didn't think about when I was younger. I just was like, oh, I'm always gonna share, I'm always gonna do this. But life gets really complicated, really complicated. And there are people in your life who also don't want to be shared, and that's difficult. Everyone has boundaries. I have new boundaries. Yeah, but I think I'm coming to a place where I'm like dipping my toe back into it. And it's interesting seeing the effect it has on me. I was actually just thinking today, I just posted a close friend story that was like, I just feel so annoying all the time. I don't know why, what's going on. And I think it's because I started posting videos again, and I've noticed like, it's like definitely the minority, but just the few comments are from someone who, I don't know, might just come across me and find me a bit annoying. And I'll be like, oh, it's not very nice. I'll hide them from, you know, my channel or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then it feels like, oh, you know, my bad brain will be like, that's the truth. And everyone else is just being nice. And so now that like narrative, and then you start like filtering, I don't know, you kind of almost like hear that tone in your head from the people who don't like you. So still figuring it out.
Well, you took a while, right? You also kind of took a detour with a band that you started with your friends.
Good God, you're in my kitchen. It's been so long, don't we look different, you said.
What was the experience of, after having been so sort of personally exposed, to get to be part of a team with Fizz and just be in a fun band?
It was really fun. Making that album was really, really fun. For those who don't know,
yeah.
I was part of a band with my closest friends who are all musicians. We wanted to like basically take a year off our own artist projects and try and see what it would be like to be part of a team. And it was really fun, but also I think it was like more difficult than we thought to leave our artist projects at the door, because obviously we absolutely have our own egos. Mm. And so working together in that way and trying to bend and shift to everyone's wants was pretty tricky. But there have been so many incredible things to come out of that whole experience. One of them is my voice. I still sing very quietly. I'm still a very quiet person, but
I can hear.
Yeah. Can you? Yes, that band like gave me permission to be a lot louder for a while, and that was really nice to like flex those muscles.
Did you learn anything about what you want musically or artistically by not getting it in the band or by having to compromise or just by being in the band?
Let me think.
I mean, were there times where you thought like, no, this lyric or this melody or this is, you know?
To be honest, I think I learned the opposite. I've always been a real perfectionist and very, very particular and very picky. Or rather, you know, I just have a very strong sense of what I like and what I want in a lot of things. There are some things I can't do, a lot of drawing or fashion or something that is not really my field. So I'll give that to other people. But in terms of music, when we were writing together, there would be a lot of times where we would like clash harmony-wise. My flatmate and best friend Greta Isaac is incredible at harmonies. She loves a lot of like really crunchy harmonies, and so do I. But obviously there's like some places where our tastes are just slightly out of line, and it was really interesting for us to be like, not sure how we compromise on this. And then we did compromise and everything was fine. And I realized that the world doesn't end and I'm not going to hate it forever. And actually, I quite enjoy that version because it's Gret and I trust Gret and I love her. So yeah, it was really interesting to like step out my comfort zone and be pulled in different ways and live in it and like it.
You and Greta also, did she write the song with you about the cat on this record?
Yes, we wrote it together. Darling Angel Baby.
Darling Angel Baby. So interestingly, because maybe that was before you, you easily co-write with her in that context, because at the end of the day, it's your song.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's because of a shared love that you have for this guy.
Well, yes.
No one could ever know me like you do. Many have tried, nothing's quite like holding you. Was in the dark, but now I've seen the light. As it turns out, life is simply black and white. Darling angel, baby, this is. Darling angel, baby, this is. Darling angel, baby, this is. Darling angel, baby, this is.
Yeah, I think because me and Gret were writing that, and at first there was no pressure around it, but then I think I realized I wanted it for my project. And then I think once that internal like grounding changes to be like, this is for Dodie, then Gret and me as well, like whoever it is, will just like again like sort of like drop their ego and be like, okay, what do you want?
Yes.
You know, they'll have suggestions, but I think Gret's really able to take a step back and kind of like lean whatever. And all of my friends who do songwriting are so good at that.
I learned as you are preparing to release this album that in all of your releases, you involve your audience. You try to drop clues, engage them in figuring out maybe what the name of the album is going to be, or maybe decipher a song. You've done these really clever projects, big involved projects that are like almost like scavenger hunts, like musical scavenger hunts. And this time, one of the things that you've done is you've open sourced a version of that song where you've provided a toolkit to your audience so that they can make a cover version of it. And you're going to do a big mashup production. Where did this sense of involving your audience come from and communicating with them on that level?
Well, back in the day on YouTube in like 2009, honestly, to like 2014, maybe, YouTube was for outcasts, for nerds. And it was my happy place. It still is my happy place. But there was a small community on there. And you would find like pockets of different communities in different places. There was a London YouTube community. I often do a lot of YouTube gatherings, which would be a lot of YouTubers and YouTube fans, but we were all part of the same community. We'd meet up in a park, and like there were a lot of teenagers in panda hats and ukuleles and people filming each other all the time. It was so fun. It was really, really fun. And we did, there were a lot of events by my friends. Like, I remember my friend Luke made an event called Subs Don't Matter because he really wanted to, like, get rid of the parasocial thing and, like, just have everyone joining in. And, yeah, it was a really good vibe. And so I think that vibe was very strong back in the day because it was for these outcasts and it felt so nice to connect with a lot of people online. And YouTube used to have something called a video response, so it was a lot more interactive. I actually think they might be bringing something like that back now. But yeah, you could reply to videos that other people made with your own video, and it was just so much more interactive and so much more community-based and fun. And I'm always trying to get that back. So this, I hope, will give me that same feeling.
You know, you said that there are some things that you don't do well, visual arts or what, I don't know, whatever. But your musical point of view and your visual point of view kind of evolved at the same time also. Like, as you became a musician and a songwriter and an artist, you also became a visual creator.
That's true.
And that's a very strong aesthetic. I've talked to quite a few people who have unraveled in a somewhat similar way. I talked to Jacob Collier years ago, and my friends in the band Wolfpack, and, you know, they've invented their language, and you invented your language.
I think about it all the time.
Tell me.
Yeah, it's so interesting because my darling mother, I love her so much. She's just so wonderful. Like, God love her. Like, a built-in aesthetic does not exist for her. Or maybe it does. It's like her very particular thing. I think we all probably have it. But I grew up, like, not knowing anything about that. Like, my aesthetics were all over the place. But I suppose just as you grow and, like, shape into a person, you start, like, leaning into what makes you you. And it's so interesting, like, what even is that? Where does that come from? I don't know how my vibe or aesthetic came together, but with people like Jacob, actually, who encouraged me to really, really lean into myself.
Yes.
I think those parts of me get sharper and stronger all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So many little choices. It's not insignificant. It might sound trivial to start with this one, but your eye makeup, you know, I mean, just like just all these things that add up to the experience of interacting with you, you know, the way it's framed, the way it's lit, the way it feels, you know.
I'm really enjoying this.
Oh, good.
No one talks about this. This is so nice.
Well, I don't understand why people wouldn't talk about this. This is so much of what it is.
It's
seems
true.
Like.
Yeah. And honestly, I think a lot of it is because I want to be special. I'm not going to lie. Like, how could I possibly lie?
That song, when you said that, was provocative to me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's just so true. It's so true. And I know it's true for a lot of other people. And I can't lie. I just, yeah, I think it's so clear. I clearly want to, like, stick in people's heads for a reason.
Right.
Yeah.
What does it mean to believe that you're special?
Well, I think everyone is special.
Yeah.
I guess what it means really when I say I want to be special is how can I be the most me I could possibly be? Like, if I turned up all of those areas, like, what does Dodie look like? And it's really fun to, like, lean into that completely. I don't think I'm, like, especially special. Do I? Maybe I do. I don't know.
Well, you've been getting a lot of feedback and a lot of reinforcement from millions of people from the time you were 15 years old.
That's true.
That say you are special.
That's so true. Getting, like, so much praise is a really weird thing to grow up with.
Yeah, I can't imagine what, you know, how you deal with just, like, figuring out who you are and what you want and who your friends are and all of that stuff. And I'm sure it's confusing, you know?
Yeah. I think I'm lucky because the YouTube thing, I share with a lot of my friends. Like, a lot of my original friends, especially in London, were people who would post online and also have an audience. And now maybe don't or have less, at least. To have that foundation of, like, I don't know. It's definitely not, like, quote, quote, peaking.
Yeah.
But it can certainly feel like that.
Yeah.
And enhance all of my worries that, you know, the good days are behind you, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah, well, right, of course, right, peaking. I see you're saying peaking too soon. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
So it can be an interesting thing to deal with, but luckily I have a lot of people who have been through it as well.
Yeah. I think it's very freeing to get past that peaking thing because then you have the rest of your life to, like, live and continue to develop and not worry about whether, you know.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, I think I actually said this in a video. I can't remember which one, but I remember like getting to 21 and like it feels like your teens to like your early 20s and even your mid 20s are like this huge ramp up.
Yeah.
And then life just like keeps going. It just keeps going. So that was a really interesting thing to learn.
I'll tell you the deepest insight that I've been thinking about apropos of that question is I think I've still been believing that death is the culmination, like it's all leading to our death, and that somehow when we die, that should be the peak, that somehow we'll know, we'll achieve some sort of enlightenment, or it will all make sense. Mm. And I'm sort of like starting to understand that it will never really make any more sense than it makes right now.
Totally. Part of my big like feelings around death was I witnessed a death. I was very lucky to witness one. Mm. My granddad, my wonderful granddad, mm-hmm. who made it very, very long.
Yeah.
He was like 98 or something.
Wow.
We were all there with him when he passed.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it was yeah. beautiful. It was also very scary.
Yeah.
And very intense.
To see life leave some, yeah. leave a body.
And the whole process of death is just a lot more like extreme than you might think. I've never really seen it represented in media mm-hmm. properly. There's like all kinds of sounds and smells and things. So yeah, having seen that, I certainly don't think life is leading to death. I think death is, I don't know what it is, but it's, primitive. And my friend Sammy often says, like, I imagine it's very similar to a birth, which it probably is. Just like, yeah, a lot more medical and bodily and like,
yes. Yes.
So yeah, I don't really know. Don't really know where the enlightenment point is. It's probably the present moment, but it's yeah. hard to get there, isn't it?
It's so hard. And to remember that, like, this is it. We're doing it right
yep.
now.
Right now.
You mentioned your mom a couple of times. What did your parents make of all of this? And you have a sister too, right?
I do, yeah. And a brother as well.
Oh.
Yes.
And so what does your family sort of make of your journey?
Well, they were worried at first, for sure. I think especially around that time, the first early times, 2010s or whatever, you know.
Did you tell them you were going to do this? Did you ask them permission? Did you just do it?
I just did it.
You started it first with your friend. You had a channel with a friend originally, right?
Didn't Ooh. You? I started like uploading novelty things just because I thought it was really cool that I could see my face on the same platform that I would watch people on. It was like seeing myself on TV, and that was so cool. And then I joined a collab channel, mm-hmm. Which again was like part of those amazing community YouTube-y days where a bunch of people all over the world would join a channel, and then each one would upload a different video for each day, and each week would have a theme. That was so fun, and it was really useful for me because I learned so many things about, like, I don't know, it just felt like homework in a way.
Yeah.
It taught me how to like edit, or you know, myself, or, like how I wanted to film myself, or what light looks best on me, how I like to cut things.
And you're 12, 13, 14 years old at this point?
At this time, I'm like 16.
16.
Yeah, 16, 17. And around the time I was 17, 18, I was doing my GCSEs and then my A-levels, and I was so busy. I was just so busy, but I loved doing YouTube, and YouTube was the hobby I would squeeze in between all of this like revising and stuff. And there was a point where I had to decide if I wanted to go to university or not. And YouTube was still kind of bubbling. It was like it had potential to be something, but no one really knew what. Yeah, and I remember my parents were just so afraid. They were like, you know, you need to go to university. You need to get a proper degree and a proper job. Like, need money, you know, so scared. And I
didn't.
Cried and cried, and I didn't. No, I moved away. I moved to a different town and sort of ignored them all. And luckily, it turned out all right. And obviously, my parents are, yeah, so proud and so surprised in their own way.
Are they musical? Are they creative?
I think internally. I don't know if they ever, like, followed it. But my dad used to play us like guitar and stuff and a lot of Beatles songs, and he was very passionate about music, and yeah, my mum would occasionally sing.
Did you sing in choir?
Yeah, in school, but it was never I don't know, it was always a hobby. I don't think I really matched the fact that I could do music as a job until I was doing it.
Yeah.
Honestly, truly, like the first videos I uploaded after that collab channel were songs I'd written, because I was like, what have I got? I don't know. I guess I'll upload my music. But I just thought it was like for fun, for like a hobby. And yeah, honestly, like I think I wanted to be an actor, which is so funny.
Well, it sounds like in a funny way, it's like YouTube it led with YouTube, and then you were like, oh, I can do music on YouTube. That's a thing I can do.
Certainly.
And it turns out that just luckily, coincidentally, you have a gift for it, or you took to it, or there was something that you were inspired to develop it, or all of the above.
Yeah. It's so, like, interesting. I think people always want to, like, categorize you in their mind of, like, are they a YouTuber or a musician? Like, what came first? Both. Honestly, both. I think YouTube is just a platform. But what I mean when I say YouTube is, like, creativity and, like, building a portfolio in some way and sharing myself and having a place to put on my music and all the other things I thought of. Like, I'm pretty sure I don't know, like, doing split screen or, like, lyric videos or stop motion or stuff like that. I think, like, yeah, creativity and my music has always been sort of, like, connected in a way.
I was thinking about that also as I was just kind of moving quickly through your the depth of the channel and your output, which is impossible to catch up on quickly. But, you know, here you have a collection of songs, 12 songs, I think, on this record. Maybe on the vinyl they had to pull one or two, I'm not sure. Are they all here?
Yeah,
because they're short. Some of them are short, so you can get them all. So 12 songs, that's the collection, the statement. It's taken you years to make. It's like the culmination of so much work and so much. But throughout all those years, there are fragments of songs, demos of songs, little songs that never turn into anything other than their primitive statement that you make of it. And that's also the work, you know? And it's sort of like, well, so how do we decide what is the Doty music that goes on a record and what is just like the song that I made and moved on from?
Yeah. Honestly, it's not very intentional. It's just like what happens to be there. I know a lot of artists write in a way where they write every day or they do a lot of writing sessions or, you know, they'll write 20 and pick their favorites. But for me, I love every song I've ever finished. I really, really do. And so I'll always want to, like, share it in some way, like you say, either online as a, what did you say, a primitive statement?
Yes.
I love that. So yeah, these, like, and I don't know if this is going to, like, help me in selling these records, but to be honest, like, whenever anyone asks me about the world or the theme or what my intention was, like, I'm like, I really don't write with an idea in mind, because I tried doing that and it just held me back. Every time I wanted to write a song that came to me, I'd be like, oh, is it in the theme? And then it wasn't, so then I couldn't finish.
Oh, like a big general theme as opposed to I mean, do you write when you're approaching a song, do you approach it thinking this is what I want? It seems that you know what you're going to say.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah. If I'm writing, it's because an idea has, like, hit me in the face.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, wow, what a interesting viewpoint on a topic. Yeah.
So tell me about Tall Kids.
Oh, you like Tall Kids?
Who are the Tall Kids?
So Tall Kids was a song I wrote from the perspective of me being 7 years old in bed and praying to God. And the tall kids for me were, like, I think, I don't know, a bad metaphor for, like, the older popular cool kids, or rather just like a group of people who are maybe intimidating or just like better in like a better place in the social hierarchy.
Yes.
Let me be with the tall kids. I will make it worth your while. They will see something in me. No, they won't run a mile. Cause look at me now, I'm high as a cloud, just dreaming about the day when the tall kids wanna play. Do the tall kids wanna play?
Yeah, I felt like an outsider in school, I don't know if you can tell, which is why YouTube was so cool and so important, to, like, find more friends and more community.
Even, like, when you asked your fans to send you recordings of them playing the song, you said, I know it's back to school time right now, so you might not have a lot of time. And I thought, you're 30 years old.
I know.
And you didn't even go to college. And still, you're still sort of saying, like, you're still kind of seeing, assuming that your fans are kids and seeing the world through the lens of...
So true. As I said that, I was like, does that even work? But also, like, I guess, I don't know, a lot of people's jobs hinge on school as well, maybe. But I don't know, I just thought I'd say it just in case. Because it does feel like at this part of the year, whatever industry you're in,
yeah.
you're all just like working really hard until Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I feel like when summer closes down and everyone starts like getting back to work. So I felt like when I said school, I meant like work in general. But right. I know what you mean. I do definitely still have to remind myself that my audience are older now. But I met a lot of them last night. I played a little like intimate show. And the main thing that people said to me was, oh, I used to, you know, love watching your videos in middle school. I don't really know when that is. I'm guessing like 14, 15.
Yeah. Okay. 12 to 14.
Right, yeah. I think my, like the main bulk of my audience, I'm overgeneralizing, but they're around like 5 to 7 years younger than me.
Right.
Which I think is actually really cool because the songs I write, by the time they come out, it's like all the things that these people are like looking at.
Yes.
So that's really cool.
And who were those people for you? Like, you know, even are you old enough? Was Ingrid Michaelson a reference? Like,
definitely.
Who were the singers 5 years older than you that you were looking at, aspiring to be like?
Ingrid Michaelson for sure, Regina Spektor, and all of those like wonderful female singer-songwriters. But also a lot of the music that my dad showed me when I was younger, the music I grew up on, like from the 70s and 80s, like. Electric Light Orchestra, and the Beatles, of course, Stevie Wonder. So I don't really know. A lot of people ask me like who my references are or my inspirations, and I can never really give a solid answer because I don't think I work like that. I don't really know what it is. I think it might be a collection of so many things like deeply subconscious in me. Like I watched The Prince of Egypt when I was younger.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that film? And the music in it. I haven't seen it yet, but I watched the first scene because I was like, I've seen this before. I just don't remember any of it. But clearly that music was like embedded into me when I was younger and it was like really inspiring to me. And I've always been a very dramatic person. I've always loved musicals.
Many nights we've prayed with no proof anyone could hear. In our hearts, a hopeful song we barely understood. Now we are not afraid, although we know there's much to fear. We were moving mountains long before we knew we could.
I feel like what you're describing and what sort of feels true to me about you is that your influences are emotional more than they are musical or specifically musical.
So
that you're drawing on a sense memory of something rather than a musical like a specific musical memory.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I think whenever I'm aiming for something in a song, I'm not aiming for the way it sounds. I'm certainly aiming for the way it feels.
Feels. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to get goosebumps.
Mm-hmm.
That's my like main thing. Yeah.
One of the songs that I discovered that you made that I did not find on Spotify, I had to find it on YouTube, is this song where you came out as bisexual in 2017. And it's a beautifully constructed little 90-second song, but I think it only exists on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. There is something I would like to tell you. I figured it out some time ago. I feel great. It makes me really happy, and I love you, so I'd love for you to know.
You seemed comfortable with it at the time that you did it. I mean, what is your thinking about sharing something like that today and doing it through the work?
Have you heard of LGBTQ+? Well, I am the B. I have a heart that could love plural genders. Yes, I'm bi, and I'm proud to be me. And just in case you were wondering, yes, I'm pretty sure it's not a trend. And though I am all for experiments, I have experimented, and I really, 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 really like it. So. Thanks for listening. Now you know more about me, something I'm proud of. I am part of something really beautiful. Because love is love is love.
You didn't just stare at the camera and say, I've got something to tell you. You made a whole thing.
I did, yeah. I mean, a lot of people think that that was my, like, coming out song.
Yeah.
But I think I, like, very gently kind of came out to myself and online over the years. The first song where I hinted at that was a song called She, which is a lot of people's favorites. And it was a song about fancying a friend, like a girl. Am I allowed to look at her like that? Could it be wrong when she's just so nice to look at? And she smells like lemongrass and sleep. She tastes like apple juice and beach. Oh, you would find her in a Polaroid picture. And she means everything to me. But I still think at that time, I remember at the end of the video, I was like, you know, this is, I don't believe in labels. I just wanted to write this because I thought it was interesting. So it took me a while to get there. So this wasn't really like a big statement, this song.
Well, it came out for Pride and it came out for something else too.
It was for a sponsorship, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was for, I used to, actually a lot of my productivity stemmed from getting sponsorships and I would get paid from them.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to just like do them loosely. So I would like try and figure out how to like make the best sponsorship. And often I would write a song or like make some sort of like creative thing.
What was the sponsorship? For Skittles?
It was for Skittles, yeah.
It literally was for Skittles.
Yeah.
Well, that's a brilliant answer to a Skittles sponsorship.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, they had this campaign where they would, like, make all their Skittles white because, you know, Pride deserves the rainbow. Well, whatever, fucking corporation bullshit. But, like, don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was so fun to do. And I always loved the opportunity because, honestly, it just felt like homework. I think, like, big important person says, here's your brief, and I go, thank you, and then I do it and get praise and money, and that was my fuel for continuing to make things a lot of the time.
Have you been in rooms for co-writes? Have you been sent in to do creative briefing like that? That's not as fun.
No. Yeah, I was
the face you made gave me a sense that it's not.
I've
so
done
fun.
A few co-writing sessions.
Yeah.
They're not for me. I don't know why. I think I just If I'm writing for myself, I think I just need it to be me and my lyrics and my world. Unless I'm writing for like a different project, like with Fizz, that was so fun, so fun. And actually that was the first time that I co-wrote and it was so easy. I was like, oh my God, we could make like three albums in a month. Like, why not? And I guess writing Darling Angel Baby with Gret was a similar experience because I'd had all of that experience with writing with them.
Right. If co-writing is maybe not your thing for you, I just got a copy of the vinyl when I walked into the office today and looked at it. And, you know, I was excited because I could see finally all the credits on the records.
Oh, yeah.
And there are very few credits on the record because it's mostly you and your co-producer, of whose name I'm forgetting.
Joe Rubel.
Joe Rubel.
There's Joe Rubel and also Peter Miles.
Right.
Did a few bits as well.
I guess it makes sense considering you have been such a self-contained person for so long that you would search out people who are just a few people to work with and keep it small.
Yes.
So what was the process like? You were in LA part of the time, you were in London part of the time?
This album was mostly recorded in London with that guy, Joe Rubel, who I've worked with before. I think, like, honestly, the mixture of Pete Miles and Joe Rubel in a lot of songs is so good. Pete Miles, we call him Analog Pete because he likes to record things very like raw and real and like spontaneous and like, you know, he'll like run around his whole studio and like, I don't know, play a tissue or whatever. And Joe Rubel is like such a great vibe as a guy. Like being in the studio with him was always so fun because we would just chat and laugh so much. And there's a lot of laughter in the album. But he's so good at adding a lot of like weight and depth. He's got all of these like electronic toys. And so smart. I don't know, like he'll be like, hear me out. Like, let me give this a go. And also I think the best thing about Joe is that I mentioned before I'm like perfectionist and like quite picky. He just laughs whenever I'm like, no, I don't like it, you know, like, oh, sorry, can we do that? Oh, I'm really sorry, like, can we try something else? He's just like, yeah, it's fine, mate, it's fine, don't worry, don't. So that's really, really nice. And also, yeah, he's just a great vibe. But yeah, I think the combo of those two was really fun.
There is kind of running through this collection of songs, and I've heard it in some in the previous record too, but here for sure, it's almost like there's this low rumble running through the whole thing.
Mm.
Like, because at the core of it, it's a pretty minimal record. It's like guitars. I noticed that you tune, do you write in drop D, or you write in low, you like low, you like, yes, to drop the tone of, yeah, the guitar.
Yeah. The lower, the muddier, the, yeah, dustier. Yes, I really,
you
like that.
You like low in the guitar, and then your voice is high, and there's this, yeah, this all this space between, yeah, them. And then even beneath the guitar, then there's this subby rumble going on,
yeah,
right? That, yeah, sounds like Analog Joe.
Yes, you're right. That's a Moog. A lot of Moogs. A lot of tom rolls or big, yeah, drum rolls as well, yeah.
Do you think I'm crazy? Do you think I'm honest? Is there anything endearing? Is this envy chronic? Am I helplessly in love with you or myself?
So it's a deceptive production because it seems empty, but it's not empty.
Yeah, I think back in the day, I used to write a lot on a ukulele.
Yes.
Mostly because I wanted to play guitar, but my hands felt too small and weak. And a uke has four strings and I have four fingers. But the like high sort of clanginess of it and my voice, really, I did not like that.
Baritone uke is an option.
That's true. And I do play baritone, yeah, uke more so. But it's kind of frustrating because I learned all the patterns on the concert. So now I don't know what chords I'm playing, uh-huh, on the baritone. And I can't be bothered to relearn them. Yeah, I don't know why I'm drawn to that like darker sound. I think probably to try and balance out,
yeah,
what can sometimes sound quite shrill to my voice. And I like to bulk up my harmonies with clarinets as well.
Yes.
Because I play the clarinet. And I feel like, I think actually Joe told me that the clarinet is like the closest thing to a pure sine wave or something, or maybe to a voice, I don't know.
To a sine wave makes sense.
Yes. So I really enjoy doing that. And then the rumbles, I think to me, feel how I feel in my body, you know? Like if I'm saying something, or if I'm seeing something, it's all light and airy, and then there's like a, you know, something happening. It feels like it's implying there's something else I'm not talking about.
Yes.
Or something else that's worrying me, or it's like about to rise up and overtake. Yeah.
Something that's just out of frame, that's looming.
Mm. Or maybe you can't really trust what I'm saying, or,
yeah,
or there's tension building. Yeah.
It's funny. This like the lead single from the record seems to be "I Feel Sorry." I feel sorry for you, Dave.
Oh,
is,
yeah,
that what it's called?
I feel bad for you, Dave.
Yeah. And you made like a very kind of charming, playful video, and Jeff Goldblum is in it. And it's a response to kind of internet trolling, basically.
Dave079 on the couch, he finds a little fire in his heart. Thumbs on glass, he writes what no one asked, and feels a little better, feels a little better. Dave is the kind of guy to lose a friend over a board game he doesn't get. Stubs his toe, lets everyone know that he can do a push-up, then he'll do a push-up. Dave, I feel bad for you. Dave, don't you know it could be better, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, for you who is so eternally online, it's notable that you wrote that song and you're leading with that.
Yeah.
You're coming strong with that.
It's funny, like, I never meant for it to be like a statement or,
yeah,
anything, but that's always hard when you write a song and it is a single and you have to surface it in the way that you do, so you're like, what am I trying to say? When in reality, it was just like, you know, a flash of an idea, like seeing an annoying comment and being like, come on, dude. That's basically all of what it means.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you over and over saying like, I don't know, you have to answer for your work sometimes in a way that you don't necessarily, you know,
mm-hmm,
mean to or need to.
Yeah.
But this is just starting now. I mean, like you're about to go forth and defend the work.
Yes. Yes, you're right. I'm going to have to talk about all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I can. Well, I think it's quite nice to be unprepared because then you just catch the
whatever comes, yeah. How is it to Like, what is your relationship with performing live after all the intimacy of your life sharing, you know, in your bedroom or whatever?
I love it. I love it so much. I used to really struggle with touring specifically, just because my mental health was pretty hard, and traveling a lot made me feel like more disconnected, and also like I said, the like, I don't know, part of my brain that's like, you're annoying, you're bad, is unfortunately quite loud. And playing shows and like standing in front of a crowd and to be like celebrated and applauded is really hard when your brain's like telling you the opposite. But I don't know what happened. I think I just like grew up a bit and like sort myself out a bit mentally. And now playing shows is just like, can I swear? The fucking best.
You can swear, please swear.
Yeah, it's the fucking best. I love it so much. I love it so much. Yeah, to like make eye contact with someone while you're singing words mm-hmm. is so nice, especially if they're singing back to you. And I've been to so many shows where I've had like spiritual experiences, like, well, not like, you know, not spiritual, but just like sure. very emotional, like life experiences where like I'm trying to like process something and then I'll hear a song and I can just process it through that.
Are there any examples that you can think of?
Yes. There's an artist called Ethan Grosker. Mm-hmm. I would say he's probably my favorite artist of all time. I actually got the opportunity to work with him on the last record. But to be honest, and I wrote a song about this as well, I think it was better to like stay a fan because I am just such a fan, just such a fan. And here's a song called...
And you feel like you lost touch with that magic of hearing him before you knew him?
I don't really know. I think it just felt like comfier to do that. Instead, yeah. I think like, you know, it's really cool to like strive for everything and to work with the people who you respect. I think in this case, I was like, do you know what? I actually think I'll feel a lot more comfortable if I just like am a fan, mm-hmm. like a really big fan. But yeah, here's a song called The Egotist, or What Are You Thinking Of? Or The Valley, or, oh no, wait, my favorite, Dialing Drunk.
All the lives I have been searching for the cure. Please, how can I ever heal you from the pain that you endure? Why am I unable? Is it because I am the source? A seed over time can bear a tree that blocks the light from shining in. I can feel the ground is sinking. I can see you cutting ties. I close my eyes. I try to see the olive branch of the dove.
He sings, why doesn't love conquer everything?
Why doesn't love conquer everything?
I was just like, wow, like sobbing. Yeah, he's the best.
I had an experience recently where I went to see a band that I'd never seen live, and people have always wanted me to go see this band. They're probably even in the UK not even known. It's this jam band called Fish. They play, there's a whole subculture, it's almost like a religion, people that love this band, and the only way I could convince myself to do it is if I was tripping on mushrooms while I went.
Nice.
And I went and I had a cathartic experience.
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking, like, sometimes the right music in the right context, it's just, it will change your life.
Exactly. I always, somehow still, forget just how important music is to my universe. I've had so many moments where I feel really, really, really stuck. And all I needed was just be in a dark room with my AirPods to listen to an Ethan Grosker album. And I'm like, oh, wait, I love life and I love music. Yeah, especially, yeah, on different kinds of substances. Yeah.
Well, Dodi, it has been such a pleasure.
I've loved all of this. It's been so nice. Thank you.
There she was, my friends, Dodi. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.